This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 22nd, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 436. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, first, the aftermath of the BC NDP government's 2026-2027 budget. My guest is Fran Yenner, editor of northernbeat.ca. Then, the five-ring circus. Joining me from the Winter Olympic city of Milan is sports agent Brant Feldman of American Group Management. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
Looking at provincial politics here in British Columbia, the legislature returned last week, and this week the legislature held the annual budget speech. The NDP government tabled its 2026-2027 budget. To talk about that, as well as other things that are going on in Victoria at the Parliament buildings, is Fran Yenner, the editor of Northern Beat. The deficit is going up to $13.3 billion. The debt's going to go up to about $183 billion. And the NDP is saying it's going to rely on changes to the provincial sales tax and also changes to the income tax rate to try to raise revenue. But there is no clear path or recipe at all towards actually bringing BC back into a balanced budget scenario for the time being for this three-year plan. What was your impression when this budget was tabled? The finance minister, Brenda Bailey, saying a few weeks ago that she'd be the most unpopular person in British Columbia. Has she met that goal?
Maybe, because I don't think this budget pleased anyone. They were scrambling to say this was not an austerity budget after Brenda Bailey's speech. And then we learned on a budget day that it in fact wasn't. So they were actually telling the truth. In talking with business leaders and associations after, what you said to your point, the biggest, I think, concern cited is the lack of a plan. First of all, the deficit, the debt, just astronomical. Historic highs and no plan to bring it down. And I just heard that repeatedly from business leaders. Like one of the things that David Williams from BC Business Council, who I think is one of the particularly articulate, he was concerned about saying that we're teetering on the edge of a debt spiral where interest rates are are outpacing our revenue. And everyone knows what that's like. If you ever had a credit card and it's racked up so much that you're only hitting the interest payments, you're not even getting down to the debt on your card. And he says that's where the province is at right now.
In this budget, that's really what they're hanging their hat on, is saying that they're going to keep healthcare, education, and public safety spending going. Are they doing that?
I mean, they're keeping it going. Whether it's being spent efficiently is the question. And certainly that's how they distinguish themselves. Oh, the conservatives are, if they were in, they would cut education and healthcare. And so that, of course, if we went into an election, that would probably be one of the primary messages, as it was last time. I don't know, $2.8 billion increase in the health budget, for instance. And one of the things that Brenda Bailey flagged was, and that's including supporting involuntary care, which obviously was a very hot issue and continues to be a hot issue as people are grappling with public disorder and the mental illness and addiction downtown, and also the violence that's erupted, in various quarters. So I sort of drilled down on that. I was like, okay, how much money is going to involuntary care? And what I learned was, out of that $2.8 billion, she flagged it specifically, $26 million is going to Dr. Daniel Vigo's involuntary care measures. And that includes the 18 beds in Surrey and in the correctional centers, and all of the ACT teams that he's sending. I don't want to drill down into the details, but it includes a lot of things. So I was specifically trying to figure out how much is going to the 100 new beds that the premier announced in September. You may recall it was the mayors kind of had a revolt and they said, you've got to do something. And during their annual municipal UBCM conference, EB announced this, oh, we're going to create 100 new involuntary beds, 50 in Prince George, 50 in Surrey, which sort of placated a little bit some of the mayors. But so I was trying to figure out, well, how much is in there in the budget for that? I don't know if it's what I heard was there's no budget. It's in the planning stage, which means no one knew how much money was actually allocated for this. And in speaking with the people up in Prince George, there's been no movement. So I don't see them taking this seriously, even though they present like they are. I don't see it in the back and behind the scenes at all.
And
so to answer your question, I don't know. They made there almost no cuts when they did the review of the provincial health authorities, as you mentioned. So they're just not able to make cuts. I just think the unions are they have such a huge portion of the budget and they've made these commitments. I don't think they have much room to maneuver in honoring those labor commitments.
They slipped in while they thought no one was noticing the abolishment of the merit commissioner. And watchdog, this legislative watchdog who looks every year at whether the government and its hiring is on a merit basis versus on a patronage basis. And it's a small office, but it's got a bit of a big job. And now more people know that this office existed and they're seeing the NDP eliminate this office. This looks bad.
It's a very bad look. And I didn't personally find the justification from Brenda Bailey compelling at all. It came up in question period this week. And she basically said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, the merit commissioner has done a lot of audits and hasn't found anything anyway. And I'm just like, that really doesn't sound like the way how you should be deciding whether to have someone who is like an independent watchdog to make sure government doesn't step out of its lane. And they have a track record for hiring and for a lot of patrons appointments. You know, you think about the boards and the ferry boards and all sorts of things. So they arguably need this merit commissioner more than ever. But as you said, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if they end up, if the opposition keeps up the pressure and if they end up backtracking on this. We'll see.
Yeah, Brenda Bailey's logic there, it's almost like saying, well, we don't need a goalie in our hockey team because the other team hasn't been scoring recently. So we're talking on February 20th, just a few hours after the United States Supreme Court decided on a 6-3 basis that Donald Trump's tariffs were illegal. And that will have an impact throughout the economy around the world and have an economic impact here in British Columbia.
The EB government has certainly relied very heavily on Trump as the boogeyman and the fall guy for everything. And Brenda Bailey did bring it up when she was asked after presenting the budget, who was to blame? One of the reporters asked. And the pandemic, Trump, tariffs, and as one of the business leaders said after, is like, okay, the pandemic isn't going on anymore as far as we know. And John Horgan's government with Carol James as finance minister left a almost $6 billion surplus so during the pandemic. So I think they would really be scrambling if they didn't have Trump to blame for everything. It is a bit of a broken record. But the thing is that Trump is so mercurial and unpredictable that I think they'll have him for the duration, because who knows what he's going to do with this? Whether he'll even listen to the court decision. He's pretty disrespectful of the justice system. So,
a big question on the horizon here in British Columbia is what's going to happen during this legislative session. It's very young, and it's supposed to last until the final week of May, and we really don't know what the blueprint is, partly because the throne speech was basically rescheduled and recast as a memorial after the mass shooting in Tumblr Ridge. What do you know of the NDP's plans for this session, of what kind of legislation they'll be tabling?
Tumblr Ridge basically shut down business and politically in Victoria for several days. And as you say, we didn't even have a throne speech. We did get a off the books briefing by a senior official to tell us kind of purportedly what we might have heard sort of in the throne speech, but it was very, very light on details. And essentially what I came out of that was that DRIPA, obviously, and administrative legislation. And one of the reporters was like, okay, but you know, between DRIPA and administrative legislation, like, what's going to fill our time there for 4 months? And not a great answer. So we don't know, is what I'm saying. It's kind of a bit of a mystery right now, which is a little strange, but not unlike like previous. I haven't been around as long as you have, but this government does like to sort of shovel out the legislation towards the end of each session. So oftentimes the legislature is surprised by stuff that comes down. I am thinking that maybe, I'm wondering if there's going to be a Section 7 agreement under DRIPA. I mean, I guess they can't do that until they resolve DRIPA, but there's been talk of different things, like they're going to regulate post-secondary to weed out the bad actor post-secondary institutions. I'm not exactly sure what that is. I don't know. Have you heard anything?
And Northern Beat has devoted a lot of attention to covering the impacts of DRIPA, which is the Declaration of Rights for Indigenous Peoples Act, which is the NDP's answer to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. So the Conservatives, under Trevor Holford, the interim leader, say they want to repeal. If they were in power, they say they'd repeal it. However, on the other side of the equation, dozens and dozens of First Nations leaders have signed letters and said, don't you dare touch it. Mm-hmm. Leave it as is. So the NDP is caught in the middle of this friction. They have to do something. Will they do something? And will it go far enough, or will it displease one side or the other?
Okay, you heard it here first. I'm predicting they will please no one. But what Attorney General Sharma said when I was talking to her a while back is that they are just very mad, and their tactic may have changed. This was in early February. Is they're going to amend the bill to make it not justiciable. So just not a law, essentially, in terms of the justice system being able to act on it. So, which I asked a few lawyers, I'm like, how does that work? You have a law that then only the government can decide how it can be applied, and you can't appeal it in the justice system. It's there's quite a bit of debate in legal circles going, is that even possible? Like, you know, it would be challenged, I guess. It's possible, of course, anything's possible. So I think they're going to try and walk that line, and because right now they're pitching it as, we're not backing down. DRIPA is the way to go. Look at DRIPA helped us sign this agreement with the Tahltan, in which the Tahltan got $2.7 billion over the life of the mine. It was probably more than DRIPA that caused the Tahltan to sign that. But so they're holding DRIPA up as this great godsend framework, and saying that they're going to just make it better. But that's what they have to say to the First Nations. But as you said, you know, the First Nations are saying, don't change a comma. Don't you dare touch that legislation. And then you've got the Greens saying the same thing. All the independents and the opposition conservatives are saying repeal. So we're going to have a tight vote if it comes down to that, which could lead to your next question, is there going to be an election or not?
Do you think that there could be a snap election this spring, or if not in the summer?
I mean, anything's possible. They're apparently slightly ahead in the polls, according to the latest bunch of different polls, ahead of the conservatives. But I did hear that, I think it was Vaughn Palmer, the god of the press gallery, is saying, you know, they have to be careful about the circumstances in which a non-confidence vote would happen, because if it looks like they could have prevented it, like, that doesn't come off very well, that they're just using it. Like, if they know that the Greens are going to vote against a DRPA amendment, that all the opposition is going to vote against DRPA, and that maybe they have one or two members or three members who have voiced opposition to making amendments to DRPA, what if they just don't show up? Like, if they know they're going to lose the vote, and they know, you know, they know ahead of time, or they should know ahead of time, how many members they're going to have there and how many are going to make the vote. And it's very precise, especially under Mike Farnworth, who's, you know, knows the job very well. If they lose it, could it be anything other than deliberate? It would be tough. But at the same time, and also, if they did it during the legislative session, they would be doing it when the conservatives essentially don't have a permanent leader. They're in the middle of a leadership race. I mean, that's a bad look too. But I still wouldn't say that they wouldn't do it, because they seem to be able to surf all sorts of sort of scandals and keep going. So I think it would be unethical, but I don't know.
Yeah, I guess the big question would be, is there even a path for the NDP to stay in power, to win an election? What really do they have left except, as you mentioned earlier, that question that they would ask the conservatives in front of the voters is, conservatives, you want a balanced budget someday, but what are you going to cut to achieve that? That would be really, I think, the only message that the NDP would have, except for, of course, playing the Trump card whenever they could. They really don't have much left.
I mean, they might, if they feel like they got thwarted on DRPA, they could maybe make that a voting issue. But I'm not sure that the public would be voting with them on that one. I'm not sure that, you know, the latest polls also were showing that people are kind of cooling on reconciliation and DRPA as this government has applied it. And that's an important proviso. As this government has implemented it, people are cooling on that. So I don't. It'd be a bit tricky making that an election issue, because certainly in the rural areas, non-starter, I think.
Fran Yenner, editor of Northern Beat, following the legislature in Victoria. Thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Bob.
The Milano Cortina Winter Olympics end February 22nd. The Paralympics are coming to Northern Italy March 6th to 15th, so still more action coming from Northern Italy. Then the focus will turn to the Los Angeles 2028 Summer Olympics, the next big event coming from the International Olympic Committee. Joining me from Milano Cortina is Brant Feldman. He's with American Group Management out of Los Angeles, a sports agent who represents athletes on both sides of the border, Canadian and American, as well as other athletes. So some of them are competing in Milano Cortina at these Winter Olympics. And Brant joins me from Milan. You're at the Starbucks US host.
It is the Starbucks Winter House, which is a collaboration between USA Hockey, USA Speed Skating, and USA Figure Skating.
And that's the one that was going to be called Ice House, but they changed that for branding and public relations reasons because of what's going on in Minneapolis, especially.
Yeah, you know what? I actually talked to Tony Driscoll, who's the vice president, managing director at USA Hockey, and Ice House name was actually a filler name until they had a corporate sponsor. I talked to him and knowing how much Starbucks branding is here in the house, I can't say to you that it would have been always the Ice House, but they needed something to sell a corporate sponsor to, so it worked out. You know, Milan Cortina 2026, 20 years ago was my first Olympics as an agent, 90 miles from here in Torino, Italy. So to see where we've gone to 20 years later at this point, I would say to you in general that the Italian people are similar to Torino. Maybe Milan is a little bit more Olympicized, but because of how far the venues are from everything, certainly it doesn't quite feel like the Torino Olympics, because it was only an hour and a half to the mountains as opposed to here where it's 2 hours away from the mountains. But at the same time, I understand that the IOC and the IPC don't want to have venues that don't get used ever again, similar to the Torino bobsled shaft that doesn't exist anymore and now to golf course.
There's Jean-Claude Killy in Vancouver. He actually said the Olympics have only a couple of jobs, which is to move people. It's to move people to and from venues, including the athletes, including the fans, including the media, and to move people with stunning performances on the field of play, whether it's ice or snow or elsewhere. So how has the movement been in Milano Cortina from a transportation standpoint of getting to and from the venues, the ones that are in the city, the ones that are in the mountains?
So here in Milan, I would say in general that the transportation system has worked relatively well. There are some bumps in the road. The B ice rink, Milano Road Ice Arena, as well as long track speed skating, they're at the city's convention center. Next week here in Milan is the is actually Milan Fashion Week. So the venue itself for that rink, you take a subway from city center and you take it all the way to Rho Theora. And when you get to Rho Theora, then you clear security about a 10-minute walk from there, all underground. And then you have to walk about another half mile to 3/4 mile undercover, but in a sense similar to SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles, where there's no walls. So it does get windy, it does get cold, but you're not gonna get rained on either. And we've had some nights where it's been raining. That venue is accessible by train, it's accessible by subway. Uber does exist here. It's pricey, if I'm honest with you. But there are a variety of Uber rides if you do want to take to get that way. The only trick here is that if you take Uber or Lyft or a taxi, it drops you off on the back end of the convention center. So then it's only a 5-minute walk then to both speed skating, long track, and ice hockey. So the Santa Ice Hockey Arena, which is where the women's gold medal game was last night, where Canada just defeated Finland, and where the U.S. is just about to take on Slovakia. You take the yellow M3 line. Sorry, Bob. Like, literally, there was a lady that won an Olympic medal, and it's right there. Oh, yeah. There you go. The Santa Gia rink, you take the yellow M3 line, so you take it all the way to the end. It's €2.20. You take it to the next to last stop, and then you get on a bus after you walk about 5-6 minutes to the from the train station to the bus line. And then at that point, you get on a bus for about 8 minutes, and it drops you off right in front of Santa Gia. Then you walk about another 1,000 yard. Hey, how are y'all? Hello. I know a few people. Don't mind me. And after you clear security, then you've got about 1,000 yard walk to the arena.
International Olympic Committee and the Olympic movement in recent years has had its ups and downs, of course, during the pandemic, and a lot of negative press for the way it's handled its own affairs. Where is the IOC today in this Olympics, and do you think that this will help it get back on track for the future?
I think the IOC made a massive mistake of having 3 games in a row in Asia. I think Pyeongchang, obviously we didn't know the pandemic was going to happen for Tokyo and then Beijing. I think having 3 games in a row in Asia was a mistake from the IOC. I think that having Paris and Milan back to back, and now we get to Los Angeles next, and then the French Alps after that, and then back to Salt Lake City. I think that the time zones work out a lot better for the IOC. That's why the ratings that NBC has right now are off the charts. I imagine CBC's ratings are exceptionally good. The European networks are doing very well here. But I haven't heard much of a drop off of the ratings in Asia. But I think having three Asian Olympic and Paralympic games was a mistake. And it's something that the IOC won't do again.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any changes in the approach of the IOC versus previous games?
I think when you become president of the IOC, you think you may know the job, but you don't know the job until you do the job for an entire games. I understand why they eliminated the Ukrainian athlete. It's a very difficult one. I get where they were coming from as it relates to that. I think that there's certainly been some operational challenges. I like going back to the ice hockey rink issue. The coordination commission probably should have been more on top of it, but they can only be on top of it as much as you can be. You won't have those same challenges with LA 28. You won't have those same challenges in 2034 in Salt Lake City. You may have those same challenges with the French Alps in 2030. So I think that in Coventry's case and her new leadership's case, that they will have learned a lot here in Italy to then know how that will then work in France. So like France apparently wants to use the soccer stadium, put a roof on it, and then put two hockey rinks on both ends in a similar manner to how U.S. Olympic swim trials were at Lucas Oil Stadium and how SoFi is going to host Olympic swimming at LA 28. They want to put two ice rinks in one building. It saves them the cost of building a stadium. There may be some sound issues that they're going to have to figure out. Still, it's a lot cheaper than building a venue. So I think that in Coventry's case, while she's been around, she's never had to be the final decision maker before. I think that she's gotten a lot thrown at her. And at least for the first time, this is the best that she could do in this particular situation.
Yeah, we did see a little bit of that kind of flavor during the opening ceremony in Milano Cortina, where there were the satellite locations where athletes in the mountains, especially because, of course, the distance, were able to participate in the opening ceremony in the March of Nations. We saw, of course, in Paris in 2024, how they used the Seine River. So we're starting to see some more.
I was a drenched rat at the Seine. I went to that opening ceremony in Paris, and I was a drenched rat by the end. And I was at opening ceremony here, and it may have been a great product for television. It did not work in the venue. Because, like, I'll give you a Canada example. Canada had a massive reach of athletes walking out onto the floor at San Siro. But no flag. Flag was in the mountains. So everyone's like, did someone drop it? Like, where is it? So like you had the flag bearers in the mountains, but the majority of Canadian athletes walk out in Milan. So again, it looked good on TV. It was great that the athletes in Milan, in the mountains, got to have the opportunity to take part in that. But being in San Siro, it was weird.
We're in a new era of women's hockey with professional women's hockey in North America, both sides of the border. Vancouver has an expansion franchise this year, of course, the Golden Knights. What do you think the hockey tournament for women in Milano Cortina will do for women's hockey for that league? And will it also raise the bar around the world that this is still a tournament that is really dominated just by two or three teams. It's almost a given that it's going to be Canada and the U.S. in the gold medal final. But do you think that by the time we get to the next Olympics in the French Alps, that there could be more teams challenging for spots in the medal round?
So, look, the bronze medal game featured two teams who haven't had a tremendous amount of success, though Sweden beat the United States 20 years ago in Torino. My first game as an agent, I saw it live when Kim Martin beat the United States in a shootout. Sweden's women's hockey program imploded. They went on strike to get better conditions. People like Henrik Lundqvist, oh my God, he's playing for Sweden here right now, Mika. They helped raise some money to try and have awareness for the Swedish women's hockey team. The Swedish women's hockey team is getting a lot better. They have a domestic league. I would say that domestic league in Sweden is the second best women's hockey league in the world. And if you don't make the PWHL, you want to end up in the SDHL. The Swiss have a domestic league also. I kind of would say it's the third best women's hockey league in the world with a great quality of living. Switzerland, like the European teams, what they really need to do to get better is that they need more of their players playing in the PWHL, playing NCAA hockey. Like there's some pioneers like Florence Schelling who should make it to the Hockey Hall of Fame. She's being inducted into the IIHF Hall of Fame this year. She went to Northeastern University. She actually played over there with Kendall Klein Schofield as an example. Alina Mueller went to Northeastern University. None of her other teammates, I think, played NCAA. They all stayed at home. So for the European players to get better, more of them need to come over here to play against the best competition all the time. As it relates to like obviously Czechia was bounced in the quarterfinal just as Finland was bounced in the quarterfinal. I do think that the Finnish hockey women, the Czech hockey women have gotten a lot better. They have more self-esteem. They have more opportunity to compare themselves with the best players in the world and their teammates with them in the PWHL. So as expansion is, we are just about to have another round of expansion in the PWHL. I do expect that more women will come from the SDHL. I expect that we will have most of the Finnish national team. I expect that we will have Swedish national team players. I expect that we will have more Swiss national team players. I expect that we will see more foreign women come to the PWHL in a similar manner to how the NHL has as many Europeans as we do in this league. Now, as it relates to how someone breaks through against Canada or breaks through against the United States, Switzerland could have beaten Canada the other night. I mean, it's a one goal game. Yes, Canada outshot them 4-1. At the end of the day, it's a one goal game. So the Swiss played a great system against Canada the other night. It may not have been Canada's best night versus them. Again, 2-1 game. But it happened just like 20 years ago with Switzerland could have been playing the United States and it would have been Torino in reverse. The Swedes, that was a big win for them to get back into the A pool again. I expect Sweden is going to be back at this point. They have things rolling. So to me, Sweden is going to be just as good as Finland and Czechia and being in the mix for things. So like that in itself, I think that's a good thing for hockey. You know, how will more countries get better at this? Investment. Like literally, if you invest in this product, you have a much better chance to be competitive in women's hockey with investment than you would in men's hockey with investment. So if teams want to get better, invest in the product.
Los Angeles 2028 is the next big event on the IOC calendar, and Winter Olympics again 2030 in the French Alps.
The Paralympic Games are next. It's in 14 days. And the Paralympic Games this year will be the third biggest sporting event in the world, behind the Winter Olympics, behind FIFA World Cup. I hope that your audience really pays attention to the Paralympics. It is coming. It is getting better. The sponsors are activating this, and they're using the campaigns in a more equal manner than they have in the past. I really want to say from London 2012 that the Winter and Summer Paralympic Games is finally getting its due. So don't sleep on the Paralympics. Take a look. I get at times that there are sports that you don't understand. You may not understand curling if you're in parts of the world. You may not understand race walking at the Summer Olympic. You may not understand these things. Pay attention to them. It's really good competition, and these athletes have killed themselves in a variety of manners to get to where they are.
Thank you again to Brant Feldman coming to us from Milan. Brant is a sports agent with American Group Management in Los Angeles.
Yes. Thanks, Bob.
Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, ex-recruits look back as alternative diplomatic service phased out. Since the early 2000s, more than 1,700 individuals have served in the diplomatic service program, mostly in countries with which Taiwan has formal diplomatic relations, according to the semi-official organization responsible for international development aid. The program will soon end. The government has scaled back the alternative service program to boost Taiwan's self-defense capabilities and eliminate potential loopholes for draft dodgers. In ABC News Australia, disgusting behavior on Tasmania's coast as penguins poked with sticks. A bystander on Tasmania's west coast has described people poking penguins with sticks, picking them up, and taking flash photography of their faces. Wildlife experts say they regularly receive reports of people interacting with the wild animals. Some experts are calling for more measures to prevent people from interfering with the penguins. In Kyoto News, South Korea's ex-president Yoon gets life sentence for leading insurrection. Yoon Suk-yeol was deemed the ringleader for his short-lived declaration of martial law in December 2024. The statutory penalties for leading an insurrection under South Korean law are death, life imprisonment, or life imprisonment without labor. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, in arena funding talks, Oregon officials are playing not to lose. On February 11th, Senate President Rob Wagner unveiled Senate Bill 1501, a framework for how state, City of Portland, and Multnomah County taxpayers would spend about $600 million to refurbish the 30-year-old Moda Center, while the NBA's Portland Trail Blazers contribute nothing. The City of Portland owns the arena. Governor Tina Kotek, the Democrat who is running for re-election with a newfound focus on economic prosperity, cheered the bill. In King 5, Seattle Seahawks go up for sale following Super Bowl win. Late owner Paul Allen's estate has commenced a formal sale process for the franchise. Allen bought the team in 1997 for $194 million. It is now worth billions. This is in line with the terms of the Microsoft co-founder's will, which directed Jody Allen, his sister and chair of his estate, to eventually sell all his sports holdings and use the proceeds for philanthropic efforts. The Seahawks lease with Lumen Field expires in 2032, at which point it will be among the NFL's 12 oldest stadiums and well behind the current trend of teams expanding luxury suite spaces.
and check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Brenda Bailey's bad news budget briefs, and widespread privacy breaches after Lapu Lapu Day massacre. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.news podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the 36 Olympians at the Milano Cortina Winter Games who are from British Columbia, plus all the British Columbians behind them, from coaches to doctors to their families back home. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar? Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.news podcast for the week of February 22nd, 2026. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 22nd of February in 1980, the miracle on ice at the Lake Placid Olympics when the Americans beat the Soviet Union 4-3? And it is the 30th birthday of pro basketball's Kia Nurse of Hamilton, Ontario. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.